What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Director, choreographer Bob Fosse reshaped musical theater, brought a singular style and the grit of real life to the Broadway stage, the big screen, and beyond. His actors danced and sang about sex and death with a high showbiz sparkle. Offstage, he popped pills, lived hard, and wrestled with his own darkness. This hour on Point, Living Dangerously, we're talking about Bob Fosse with the author of a big new biography. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you see what our biographer calls Bob Fosse's bejeweling of horror on stage and screen? In Chicago, in cabaret, in all that jazz. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California, is Sam Wasson, visiting professor of film at Wesleyan University and author of the New York Times bestseller, Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m., Audrey Hepburn, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and The Dawn of the Modern Woman. His big new book is Fosse. No subtitle. Who needs it? Just Fosse. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Sam Wasson in California, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us.
Hi, thank you.
Just great to have you here. Wow, you really dug in. This must be hundreds of interviews. I mean, this is the full dress biography. Who did you go to find out about this iconic figure?
Well, I tried to speak to as many people as I could. One of the great virtues of writing about Fosse is that it's modern or virtually modern contemporary history. So pretty much everyone is around. I got to Anne Reinking, thankfully, and Dustin Hoffman and Stephen Sondheim. I had a terrific interview with, and about 300 other people.
He died at age 60 in 1987. Still seems incredibly present. I mean, just in the last few days, they're talking about Fosse on Dancing with the Stars. What was it that this, I mean, we're going to look at this in some detail here, but what was it that he brought to that big world that was hardly without razzle-dazzle before him and hardly without darkness, but that was new, that transformed it, you and others say?
Well, I think you said it in your introduction, the combination of sex, wit, and despair is something that we all can relate to in some form or another. And packaging them together gives it a complexity that's constantly inviting. And I think that, you know, we never get tired of. And also, he's using a show business idiom. He's constantly referencing, whether it's the Marx Brothers or Chaplin or Jimmy Durante, signs and gestures that we as, you know, pop culture fans understand. So his style is legible to even a dance illiterate person.
Ethan Warden gives you a wonderful review in the Wall Street Journal. And in part in there, he talks about Bob Fosse's third marriage, famously to Gwen Verdon.
Yeah.
He calls her the greatest woman dancer in the musical's history. She was the icon, he writes, of the Fosse look, which he describes as something like a broken puppet with a wicked idea of fun and no conscience to speak of. Talk just in choreographic terms first about what does that mean? What was it that Gwen was doing that he was asking for that was the Fosse look?
Well, that's a perfect description by Ethan Morton. The broken puppet, there you have the despair, that turned in look, and where, you know, each part of the body seems to be moving on its own. There's really doesn't seem to be a sense of soul sometimes. And then that mischievousness, that wickedness, there's the wit and there's the sexuality. And that comes through a lot of times in the performance of the dancer. Not all choreographers ask their dancers to act to bring personality and character into the dance. And that's another thing that makes this work so accessible and so popular, I think, that we are constantly connecting with character all the time. And Gwen Verdon had all of that. I mean, she had an overwhelming personality, and she also was Jack Cole's dance assistant. Now, Jack Cole is a figure that may not be familiar to a lot of people. Mm. He was, up until Fosse, pretty much the last word in exotic, sensual dance. Much more of an Eastern feeling than Bob's, Fosse's, who mm-hmm. was much more Western influenced, you know. So Gwen came to Fosse understanding how to move with sex. She studied with Cole and brought that right into Fosse. They spoke each other's language really before they even knew what they were saying to each other.
So if you had to describe Broadway dance before Fosse versus Broadway dance after he'd left this great big imprint, what's the change? What's the before and after comparison?
Well, the great American style on Broadway, I think, would be sort of acrobatic. I think Gene Kelly would be closer to it, big and bold and playing to the farthest balcony. And then there was, of course, you know, the Agnes DeMille school coming up in Oklahoma, which had a much more classical, balletic style. So you have a kind of high and low, and Fosse was, I think, a perfect amalgam of the two of them, both of them. Neither really had darkness, and at best they had wit, but it was a much more physical, slapsticky kind of humor. Fosse's sensibility was subtle and mischievous.
And sexual and dark,
sexual.
As was so much of the life that you write about. Let's keep the sound of this in our ears as we go. I mean, he was there so early on. The name still sounds quite contemporary, but his Damn Yankees, all the way back in 1955, Sweet Charity, 1966, Pippin, 72, and then 1975, Chicago Hills. Here is Cell Block Tango. Bob Fosse, the man behind this, directing, choreographing, co-wrote the book of Chicago, Darkness, Sensuality, Death, all with that showbiz sparkle running through the show. Here's Cell Block Tango featuring the merry murderesses of the Cook County Jail singing about their crimes.
Pop, sit, squint, Cicero, lip, shit. Pop, sit, squint, Cicero, lip, shit.
He had it coming. He had it coming. He only had himself to blame. If you'd have been there, if you'd have seen it, I bet you would have done the same. Pop, sit, squint, Cicero, lip, shit.
Chicago's Cell Block Tango, 1975. And he had hit after hit, but you described him as being always desperately afraid of failure. Why didn't he see that he had kind of a mastery here?
Well, that's one of the most complex questions of the book, and one of the things that kept drawing me back to Fosse. You know, I mean, he felt neglected by his parents early on. He was a small child. His older brothers were tough guys who, you know, could outbeat him in most every sport. So he comes into the world feeling insignificant, and on top of that, always wanted to be Fred Astaire, which he never really became. Choreography was a plan B for Fosse, amazingly. So even as he's climbing the ranks and winning the Oscar and the Emmy and the Tony in 1 year, which, by the way, no one had ever done
before. 1973, Cabaret year, was it the year?
That's Cabaret, Pippin, and mm-hmm. Liza with a Z, mm-hmm. The Triple Crown. Mm-hmm. Just an unbelievable feet of show business genius. He still feels lousy, and it's because, well, I really just wanted to be a dancer. I'm sort of just faking my way through it. I don't know how to choreograph like Jerome Robbins. I can't master the classical style. I've got a few tricks, maybe six steps. I keep rearranging them, and for whatever reason, you know, America keeps falling for it. So he was waiting. he was waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yes, maybe he wanted to be even the greater dancer, but there was a bigger kind of deal. You call him Faust and Mephistopheles all at once on both sides of that bargain. What do you mean?
Well, he tortured himself. He needed, on the other hand, he needed that darkness. He needed that engagement with death to feel like he well, to feel like he had to fight, to crawl out of the hole he was in. That was the muse in a way. So he was his own devil. He created bad guys. He created enemies. He was his own enemy. But out of that came, you know, this Faustian glory of great work.
Always side by side. I mean, you describe terrible periods of depression, a womanizing that really never end, kind of ends, pill popping all the way along. Was the creativity steady through that, or was it fits and starts?
It was unbelievably steady. Fosse never stopped working, and beyond that, never stopped challenging himself, never stopped growing, never stopped pushing the envelope into darker depths of despair on stage and screen. If you look at Fosse's shows, and especially his films, beginning with Sweet Charity, then going to Cabaret, and then Lenny and All That Jazz, and finally Star 80, which is his last movie. Mm-hmm. You'll see each movie tries to get darker, bleaker, more honest than the last, till you get to Star 80, which is
about the death of a Playboy bunny.
Yes, the murder. I mean, just the most mm-hmm. grisly murder, and it's almost unbearable to watch.
And all the while, there's the razzle dazzle. It could kind of wash away some of the dark, even though it was right there in front of you. Sam Wasson writes about all of it in a terrific big new biography of Bob Fosse. It is Fosse. He joins us today from NPR West in Culver City, California. Here's Rich Man's Frug from 1966, Bob Fosse's Sweet Charity. You can join us. Are you still a Fosse fan? How would you describe how he changed dance on Broadway and beyond? Could you see the darkness behind, right there with his dazzle? Could you see it in his work? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Broadway dance king Bob Fosse, the creative force behind Chicago, the films Cabaret, and All That Jazz. Behind us right here, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, 1961 Coffee Break. There's no coffee, and it's a desperate situation. There's a big new biography out on his turbulent life. Sam Wasson is the author. He joins us today from NPR West in Culver City, California. The book is Fosse. You can join us. Could you see the darkness behind Bob Fosse's dazzle? Did you dance for Fosse? Tell us, what was that like? What was the Fosse treatment, the Fosse way? Could you see it in Joel Grey in Cabaret, in Ben Vereen in Pippin, Gwen Verdon in Chicago? Are we in a new big age of dance with Fosse's stamp still on it? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Sam, here we are. We're just talking about a coffee break. Where's the darkness?
Oh, well, this is a song about addiction. And Fosse understood addiction probably better than any other Broadway choreographer that ever lived. And in this number, you see the sort of fits and starts of withdrawal and desperation. Fosse made an absolute direct link between the two.
Give us some more of those moments. I mean, all the razzle-dazzle, I think, for a lot of people, covers up some of that dark, and yet it's staring us right in the face. Give us those moments from stage or screen when the Fosse darkness is just staring at us, even with the razzle-dazzle around it.
Well, you see it, you mentioned Ben Vereen in Pippin, and you see it throughout Pippin. This is a show in which Fosse really begins to turn down the volume, turn down the exuberance, and focuses in on smallness and slowness, and that gives his dance a sort of sinister quality, a menacing quality, and a sensuality that we hadn't seen in Broadway dance before. before. It feels dark somehow because we're used to Broadway dance being big. Gene Kelly, like I said. And in Pippin, something's off. It feels wrong. And the slowness and the smallness has something to do with that. It lends the show an irony that feels strange, and at the same time invites you to lean forward and try to figure out, well, what's going on beneath the razzle-dazzle, beneath Ben Vereen's great big shining smile.
And by the time he got to the film version of Cabaret in 1972, really unavoidable, the opening number there, Willkommen, with Joel Grey as the Kit Kat Club MC, becomes genuinely a sinister figure with very unclear motives in the Fosse treatment of Cabaret on film.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome, fremde, étranger, stranger, glücklich zu sehen, just wie enchanté, happy to see you, bleibe reste stehen.
Joel Grey, Cabaret, Bob Fosse's. I mean, how could that not be dark, Sam? After all, it's Nazi emerging years in Germany.
Right. And Joel Grey smiling a little too big. The camera's just a little too close. It feels pushed. It feels like the razzle-dazzle's trying too hard, and it's covering something up. And, of course, you just said exactly what that is.
Bejeweled horror is your great phrase for what he put together. Was it conscious? Did he say, I want the dark, and I want the dazzle, and I want it all at once?
Yes, he knew it. He knew, because too much darkness is going to scare him off. No one's going to buy a ticket to that show. And too much light, well, Broadway had already done that. That's not really pushing the envelope. And Bob knew that in order to be a great artist, in order to be a genius, which is what he always wanted to be and never felt he was, he had to push that envelope into despair or hopefully hell. So the only way he could do that was to shine a little razzle-dazzle on life. But that was also what his whole life was about. He had to keep pushing. He had to keep going to work every day, even though he felt like he was a failure and he was fooling them. So that's really what his biography is. It's the story of razzle-dazzle covering up the darkness. And I think we can all relate to that in some form or another.
Tell us about the offstage part of that, the despair, the hell in his own life. You mentioned addiction already. What about it?
Well, yeah, early on, Bob got into amphetamines and was pretty innocent of what it was all about at first. In the 50s, it was widely prescribed as a sort of miracle cure. And Fosse didn't really understand why, but it was helping him feel better, and it was helping him go into the studio. He would call Dexedrine his care pills. He would say speed was really the only way to get him to care about the color of a bow on a dancer's hair. And without it, who knows if he would have gotten into the studio. He would have been a genius either way. But the drugs, I hate to say it, I mean, they helped him work. And it's a short step away from relying on them from dependency to addiction. And unfortunately, combined with the chronic heart disease that ran in his family, which he was also conscious of, he was playing with death all the time. He knew it. And adding to that the cigarettes and the womanizing and the constant work, death was always over his shoulder. But as we discussed, I mean, he liked it there.
And speed as something behind that sort of micromanaging perfectionist reputation
exactly.
That he had so largely. Women and womanizing. I mean, you just described this unending stream. How did he look at it? How did they look at it? How did his wife look at it? The greatest musical dancer of all time is third.
Yeah. I know. It's a fabulous question and so fascinating. I mean, how did he get so many women? How did he keep so many women? How did they keep all coming back and forgiving him? Because once Bob was with a woman, he was pretty much with her for the rest of his life. I mean, where there is an open relationship, there isn't ever really a reason to close that relationship. And Fosse laid it out right on the line when he met a woman. He would say, look, this is what I'm capable of. This is not what I'm capable of. There's the door, but please don't walk through it. Please stay with me.
And who were his targets? Were they dancers? Were they collaborators? Were they people outside the business?
It was a beautiful woman. Anyone. Now, that ran to dancers most often because he was around dancers all the time. And being, you know, one of the only straight choreographers in a predominantly gay world, he was, as Buddy Hackett said, a kid in a candy store. And then the power dynamics that go on with that, his own innate charm and sexuality, which he did have, and the fact that he could be giving them jobs, that they admired him so much. I mean, he was just irresistible. And a huge part of that was his relentless honesty at all times and lacerating self-loathing. I mean, it was hard to turn away.
It is so interesting how his shadow is still out there, his reputation. This is just from this week, Monday, an episode of ABC's Dancing with the Stars, and contestant Corbin Blue wowed the judges there with a Fosse-style dance. Judge Carrie Ann Inaba could barely contain her enthusiasm. High praise here, Fosse, for the routine.
That may be the best routine I've ever seen in all 17 seasons. Many people try to emulate Bob Fosse, and no one ever does it as good as Bob Fosse. I think you did what Bob Fosse would have done today in this day, and I think he would have loved you.
It's kind of incredible. Here we are in 2013. He's been dead since 1987 and still that vivid. Of course, you know, it's schmaltz, but there it is, right in the popular culture. And in more ways than just here, you say he's kind of crept into many parts of popular culture.
Well, the dance being the most important. Mm-hmm. This Bob Fosse is hip hop. There is no hip hop without Bob Fosse. And unfortunately, one of the sadnesses of this life is that he didn't live long enough to really see what he had created.
Explain that, because I'm not sure people would instinctively understand what you mean by that connection.
Well, to think about Michael Jackson, for instance, who I think is probably the greatest inheritor of the Fosse tradition, the Fosse style.
And your report couldn't get enough of Fosse. Collected everything about Fosse, Michael.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Jackson had a huge catalog of everything Fosse had ever done and danced in. And actually, I wasn't surprised to learn wanted Fosse to direct Thriller. Fosse was actually Jackson's first choice. And then subsequently, Fosse went to Neverland Ranch to meet with Jackson and decided against it on the grounds that Jackson was just too weird.
But even for Bob Fosse.
Too weird for Bob Fosse, yeah.
okay.
Which is saying something. But Fosse was just in awe of Jackson's talent. And in terms of hip-hop and drawing the connection between Fosse and Jackson and hip hop. I mean, it's a complex assortment of influences. But one of the defining characteristics of Fosse is the notion of isolation, which is moving just one part of the body at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is in total conflict with the ballet tradition, which is about moving the body as a whole, and sort of a cohesive and fluid expression. Mm-hmm. Fosse is bumps and grinds, pops and locks before we called it pop and lock.
And there's Michael Jackson. I mean, think of the hand, the hips, the feet, and each doing their thing, sometimes singularly.
Exactly. And that gives it the broken look that mm-hmm. Morton was writing about.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is the seed of hip hop movement.
Here's Bob Fosse himself when he won Best Director, the Oscar, for Cabaret in 1973, comparing himself a little to Clint Eastwood, who had to stand in for Charlton Heston presenting an award earlier in the ceremony when Heston got a flat tire.
I must say I feel a little like Clint Eastwood. That you're letting me stand up here because Coppola or Mankiewicz hasn't shown up yet, but being characteristically pessimist and cynic, this and some of the other nice things that have happened to me in the last couple of days may turn me into some sort of hopeful optimist and ruin my whole life.
Turn me into a hopeful optimist and ruin my whole life.
Isn't that great? I'm so glad you played that. That is so the guy. And right there you have the razzle-dazzle of the joke, the charm, covering up the despair. And and so successfully that you might wonder if Bob was full of it, if he's just using his despair and anxiety as a way to get attention or to invite you to say, oh, no, 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 Bob, you are a genius. You are being too hard on yourself. And a lot of people I spoke with happened to feel that that was true. But in fact, far more people understood that that really is just Fosse's way of putting on a show. But deep down underneath, he really did feel like the Oscar went to the wrong guy. He felt like that his whole life.
We're talking with Sam Wasson about his big new biography, Fosse. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Dean in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Hi, Dean. You're on the air.
Tom, thanks for taking my call. I'm in a very rural area, so I may lose you, and I'm going to do this quickly. I was a theater major. Joe Papp was one of our mentors, and the thought of going to New York and auditioning for Fosse scared the bejesus out of me.
Why?
The thought of a 12 to 18-hour rehearsal 4 weeks, just that, like, I didn't think I would be able to survive it. And I don't think I was the only person that thought that. So would love to get your guest feedback on whether rehearsals were really that bad. I was afraid it would just be a brutal experience and I wouldn't make it.
Great. I'm so glad you raised it, Dean. Thank you for your call. Sam, how about it? The actual experience of dancing for Bob.
Yes, Dean, we're all behind you. I could testify to hundreds of dancers having been there. Yes, it was that bad. Bob was relentless. Anyone coming from, as we say, that kind of darkness, that kind of feeling of behind the eight ball has got to work everyone that much harder to get to a place of security. Now, that's the dark side. The razzle-dazzle side, because they always go together in Fosse, is that if you can stick it out, if you can last through those 14-hour auditions and just back-breaking rehearsals, you will come out with the greatest work of your life. He was never abusive, Fosse. He was never wasteful. He was just absolutely tough. And I think the tribute to that is what's on the screen.
Did the dancers feel, or early on, let's say, that he was introducing them to a new way of dancing that they may not have learned as professional dancers before
they
hit Fosse?
Yes, this is not a natural way to move. And it physically hurts sometimes. I mean, there are dancers today with Fosse knees and Fosse hips, and that's not a good thing. And they limp if they didn't do it right. Now, many did do it right, and they're perfectly fine. But to give that broken look, you have to move counterintuitively. And that takes a lot of practice and a lot of pain.
He won an Emmy in 1970 for the 1972 Liza with a Z. This was a TV special. What was his role there and his relationship with Liza Minnelli?
Well, he had worked with Liza on Cabaret just before he did Liza with a Z, and I'd say is responsible for making Liza the great phenomenon that she was, which isn't to say Liza isn't extraordinarily talented on her own. But the combination of Fosse's broken down showbiz aesthetic and Liza's own desperation, that please love me almost garishness that she has, were a perfect combination. And packaging them in Cabaret, which is really a movie about these things, served everyone. So following that with Liza with a Z, which is her one-woman show concert that Fosse filmed for television, was the perfect one-two punch to break Liza out into the world.
She did that in a very big way with Bob Fosse right behind her. Sam Wasson's big new biography is Fosse. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join the conversation this hour. Sam, stand by there in Culver City, California. Listeners, does Bob Fosse's private life surprise you? The addiction, depression, womanizing, or maybe not? And does being tortured, depressed, suicidal, on pills come with this tier, this territory, his way of doing it? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Here's Liza Minnelli from Liza with a Z, 1972. Bob Fosse directed. What an Emmy for it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Broadway dance king Bob Fosse, creative force behind Chicago, the film's Cabaret, and all that jazz. Behind us right here, the opening number Magic to Do from 1972's Pippin, directed by Bob Fosse. Sam Wasson has a big new biography out. It's called Fosse. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Of course, behind us right here, Ben Vereen is the leading player in Pippin, a character that Fosse revised heavily, changing him from a benevolent narrator to a more sinister figure who ultimately seeks the death of Pippin. You can join us this hour. Were you a Fosse fan? Are you still? How would you describe how he changed dance on Broadway and beyond? Could you see the darkness behind the dazzle? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Sam, stand by there in Culver City, California. We've got callers for you. Lydia in Lexington, Massachusetts. Lydia, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Hi.
I was 13 years old in 1973, and I had a great perspective on Fosse. My folks were in advertising, and we saw everything he, you know, ever did. And to talk about it in a coming-of-age kind of way with everything else that was going on for women and the culture at that time, I think would be a great addition to this. There was Roe versus Wade, Title IX. Fosse did so many female protagonists, and they were vulnerable but not powerless. In Cabaret and It seemed like before that women were good girls or bad girls, and he somehow showed a third way. And women in his work were not bad for being sexual. They were bad for being murderers, but they weren't bad for being sexual. And it opened up a new way right at the time when women were gaining so much power.
And right at the time when, Lydia, you were 13 and probably very ready to hear. It's a great point to raise. Sam, what about it on female empowerment, female sexuality, and the vulnerability in Fosse's
hands? Absolutely right. This is one of the reasons that women dancers love to dance Fosse, and one of the reasons I love to watch Fosse. One of the reasons we all love to watch Fosse. Now, if you brought that up to Bob, he would have said that this is a completely apolitical effect of his work. Bob was really just speaking autobiographically. This was Fosse's view of women. They were powerful to him. They were scary to him, and they did touch him. He loved them and he feared them. They were everything to him. He casts Jessica Lange in the role of Death, who flirts with him the whole movie throughout all that jazz before she kills him. So what more powerful, sexy figure could there be than Death? So yes, you nailed it. That's it.
A listener, Kurt, on Facebook writes, "No man has any business telling a woman what she should do with her body, except for Bob Fosse." Kurt writes, "I don't know."
Certainly told them what to do with their bodies. That's for sure.
What like in Jessica Lange's case, or other his dancers? How did they think of his direction?
Oh, they loved him. They worshipped him. Look what he did to them. Of course, they had to go through a lot of difficulty and personal difficulty too, because to be in the studio with Fosse was not only a physical challenge but an emotional challenge, because he always brought sex in there on a one-to-one basis. He was constantly calling them late at night, asking them to come over. Why won't you come over? Can you come over tomorrow? Mm. And that's a tough environment, needless to say. An impossible environment. But
did they complain about it? Did they openly complain about it?
Sure, absolutely. There was a lot of complaining about it, but they were also getting something from it. It was very, very complex.
Lydia, I'm glad you raised that vector, such a big one here. Dan in Charleston, South Carolina. Dan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, Sam. I appreciate that you brought up all that jazz, the film. I'm a great fan, and from all you said, it sure sounds like that was a rather bare and honest portrayal of Fosse's own life. I was hoping you could say more about that.
Yeah, that is pretty much Bob Fosse. I say in the book that's 100% true to about 70% of Bob Fosse. The other big chunk of Fosse, which I'm glad to talk about because I haven't really highlighted it so far, was that he really was a sweet guy on top of all this, on top of being a dangerous guy, on top of being a tough guy and a dark guy. He was also the life of the party. And if you just think about it in purely practical terms, how are you going to be able to keep all of these dancers together show after show, working with the same people, you know, even though they turn out the great work of their lives? If he really was putting them through hell and wasn't charming them throughout, there is no way they would return to him. And there was no way that they would enjoy being in bed with him, going out with him. He was a sweetheart. And in all that jazz, you kind of get a sense of that. But one of the reasons you don't is Fosse wanted to be as hard on himself as he was on everyone else. And he wanted to show, from the perspective of a morality tale, how show business is dangerous and how show business can kill you. And if he let Joe Gideon get off easy, then the point of the movie wouldn't come across. And the big downside of that is that for generations, for decades, people have misread Fosse as this kind of tough guy villain. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was to correct that misconception that Fosse was ironically a part author of.
Sweetness there also, but always that shadow of death. I mean, we've got a little track here from, of course, All That Jazz. This is Bye Bye Life, 1979 film, mostly autobiographical, as you say. It ends with the death of Joe Gideon, the clear stand-in for Fosse. And in the film's final number, Bye Bye Life, Ben Vereen leads a big showbiz farewell to life as Gideon, played by Roy Scheider, finally embraces the angel of death and is zipped into a body bag.
He's gonna die. I think he's gonna die. I think I'm gonna die.
Razzle dazzle and death. All in, talk about a package. There's a body bag.
Yeah.
Andy in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Andy, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes, just fabulous. The dark and the light. The guy, like so many artists, I imagine, was like this magnesium, you know, in a dark background. Just amazing, amazing. Other artists that he makes me think of, I mean, the poet Dylan Thomas and Frank Lesser, who he collaborated with, 58 when he died. Boy, did he lick his cigarettes. And he had that kind of drive, too, I think.
They worked together on How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, I think.
Yes. Yes, and so I wondered whether Mr. I forgot his name, sorry.
Sam Wasson is with us, yeah.
Yes, whether he might talk about Fosse's relationship with Lesser. That's enough.
Yeah, good. Good.
It's great. It's a great question. Bob and now Fosse was intensely competitive, Not with Lesser. He loved Frank Lesser. They were guys together. They were sort of like dead end kids hanging out on the corner. You know, what's the number from Most Happy Fella, watching the girls go by? That was Bob and Frank Lesser. And they did work together on How to Succeed, and also on a show called Pleasures and Palaces, which closed out of town. They did both have that unbelievable and relentless drive. Whereas Lesser, I think, was a man of the early Broadway, classical Broadway. Fosse was really an author of the modern Broadway. So you can see a baton passing there between the two guys. Absolutely. And they loved each other their whole lives and remained close.
There's one that I never really grabbed onto, but a lot of our listeners are asking about it, even citing it as one of their favorite Fosse moments here. And it's his performance in The Little Prince as a snake in the grass. Can you describe that show, what it was, his role, what he depicted?
Well, that was a movie by Stanley Donen, and Fosse plays the snake. And
he's actually in the show as the snake. He's not just on the side.
Yes, he plays the snake. That's right. Yes. Yeah. And the song he sings to this, you know, 7-year-old blonde child, the little prince, is about suicide, which right there is startling in and of itself. But to see this number, which you should just Google on YouTube, I mean, it's right there and it's just stunning. The genius is absolutely clear. You can see the direct link between Fosse and Michael Jackson and ultimately hip hop.
That is at our website, I should say, and you should check it out. It's really amazing.
Yeah, it's one of Fosse's greatest numbers, and to see it danced by Fosse himself adds an authority and just another level that you don't get with all other Fosse numbers because they're not danced by Bob. I'm really glad you brought that up. It's a crucial number.
Here's a little bit from that. This is 1974 musical film The Little Prince. Here's Snake in the Grass. Bob Fosse plays the snake.
If you would like to cure the fever called life, get some relief from all the struggle and strife, the grandest medicine that I can propose is under your nose, a snake in the grass.
And yes, that is Bob Fosse's voice singing in The Little Prince, Snake in the Grass, 1974. You can see that video at our website, onpointradio.org. They're suggesting suicide to a child. Maybe a good point to talk about Bob Fosse's own periods of depression and where that led him, Sam.
Well, you look at Pippin, and Pippin is a show, you know, you played Magic to Do, you know, Join Us starts off as a kind of happy, show-busy number, you know, welcome to the cabaret sort of thing. But by the end of it, we learn that Join Us really means join us in death. And the audience is fooled by the show business charm of the whole thing, just as Pippin is. And Snake in the Grass is about the exact same thing. No wonder Fosse was attracted to it. He would often think about death in terms of the sting of a snake. He would talk to a girlfriend he had, Janice Lind, about that well before he even played the snake. So he understood what this is about. This is a purely autobiographical expression for Fosse. And I think worth noting also that his voice is very slight. It's not a great voice. And you could see why he really couldn't cut it as a song and dance man. Where Astaire's voice was slight, had a kind of whimsical charm, Bob's didn't. It was kind of flat at best.
He was not unfamiliar with the inside of a psychiatric ward. At what age? What circumstances?
Well, after he won the Triple Crown, the Oscar, the Tony, and the Emmy, he checked into Payne Whitney. It wasn't the only time he checked into Payne Whitney. But, of course, it's surprising. We would think, well, he should be on top of the world. He was on top of the show business world, getting calls from Frank Sinatra, from everyone. And yet, that's what one of the things that really destroyed him, because the disconnect between how he felt and what reality was showing him was so profound. He had to run away. He just could not handle it.
The success up against what his fears, his awareness of the dark.
His sense of what reality was, which is that he was faking, and that he was a failure, and that where does he go from here? I mean, there's also that aspect of it. When you're on the mountaintop, how do you top that? How do you do that? Well, the answer is Lenny, all that jazz. So he actually does go on to top it, which is another reason that this is such an amazing story. But at that moment in 1972-3, he doesn't have that answer yet. All he has is just the darkness before him and the absolute assurance that there's going to be no way out. His life is over.
Here's Fosse's voice once again. This is from an interview in the early 1980s with David Sheehan of CBS. Bob Fosse.
Like anyone else, I'm afraid of failure. And afraid that the ideas that I have, I don't have the talent to execute. I think I would like to do better things, more important things, and at the same time there's a fear that I don't have the equipment, the talent, the intelligence to bring them off. You know, like Chaplin said, all of us are amateurs, none of us live long enough to be anything else but.
Quoting Chaplin, all of us are amateurs, none of us live long enough to be anything else but. Sam, you've said that Bob Fosse built such a kind of powerhouse of razzle-dazzle and showbiz that in some ways he built a showbiz culture that now permeates everything, that we're all part of, whether we're in showbiz or not. What do you mean?
Well, it's the Warhol idea, but just perverted to absolute hell. I mean, look at Chicago, for instance. This is a show about how celebrity gets away with anything, and integrity and human values don't really matter as much as how those values are presented, the externals. That's showbiz. And that's pretty much the world we live in, I think, in nearly every respect.
You mean everybody's performing now?
Everybody's performing, not just right now on the radio. I'm performing. I mean, I'm terribly scared being on the air right now.
But is that new? I mean, Shakespeare, you know, all the world's a stage. Is it new in Fosse's hands?
No, it's an old idea, but Fosse takes it into it's to its nihilistic extreme. I mean, if nothing, this is not all the world's a stage. Isn't that glorious? This is all the world's a stage. Nothing is real. Nothing has meaning. We are in big trouble. And it's no coincidence that Chicago comes out at the height of the Watergate crisis, one of the biggest, darkest American performances in history.
Nothing is real. Nothing has meaning. But let's dance.
You got it. You got it.
Here's Bob Fosse. Sam Wasson writes the life up in great and grand detail in his big new biography, Fosse. He's joined us today from NPR West in Culver City, California. Sam, thank you very much for the book, and thanks for your time today. Wonderful to hear your thoughts on Bob Fosse.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
We will go out with Razzle Dazzle from Fosse's Chicago, sung here by Jerry Auerbach and the chorus. Join us tomorrow for Amy Tan, talking about the courtesan life of old Shanghai. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Talents, razzle dazzle,
razzle dazzle.